Hello, everyone. An extraordinarily speedy greeting at the start of the podcast from me, because this is the first podcast I've edited in about 4 weeks due to the birth of my second child, and I'm quite tired. So mostly just to say, as ever, thank you for listening, and also please be aware that due to a technical problem that I cannot quite suss out, the audio quality in this week's show is a bit weird, particularly with our guest Ignacio's audio. It sounds quite appropriately, to be fair, like he's talking to us via a stadium PA announcer system. So just enjoy that as being extraordinarily on theme with the show. The only thing to say is hello to Charlie Arl, a listener who got in touch to tell us that their child, completely unbeknowing of this podcast, named their new pet goldfish Buffy, Ben and Barry. So we're delighted that we now have actual live mascots for this show. That is it for me. You might even be able to hear my child yowling in the background, so I'm going to go and assist my wife with getting her to bed. Enjoy the show. Me or Barry will talk to you more next week. Thanks as ever for supporting us online. Goodbye. Hello, mighty podcast listeners, and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that each week celebrates the best of the worst. I'm Ben van der Velde, and I don't know what to say, really. 3 minutes to the biggest podcast of our professional lives. All comes down to today. Either we heal as a team, or we are going to crumble inch by inch, gag by gag, trivial fact by trivial fact, till we're finished. We're in hell right now, gentlemen. Just look at the news, believe me. And we can stay here and get the shit kicked out of us, or we can fight our way back into the light. We can climb out of hell one inch at a time. Now, I can't do it for you. I'm too old. I'm 37, I've got two kids, and one of them woke me up at 5:15 a.m. this morning. I look around, I see these young faces, and I think, wow, Barry's really been moisturising through lockdown. You know, when you get old, in life, things get taken from you. I mean, it's a part of life, but you only learn that when you start losing stuff. You find out life's this game of inches, and so is podcasting. Because in either game, life or podcasting, the margin for error is so small. I mean, one misplaced promo for 23andMe. One slapdash piece of editing, you don't quite make it. Adam Buxton continues to ignore you. The inches we need are everywhere around us. They're in every break of the show, every minute, every second. On this podcast, we fight for that inch. On this podcast, we tear ourselves and the entirety of human endeavour to that piece. To fuck me, Al Pacino makes this look much easier. On this podcast, we tear ourselves and the entirety of human endeavour to pieces for that inch. We claw with our fingernails for that inch and then get a really bad fish manicure. Because we know that when we add up all those inches, that's going to make the fucking difference between winning and losing, between living and dying, between being the 54th best podcast in Vietnam and the 53rd best podcast in Vietnam. I tell you this, in any podcast, it's the guy who's willing to die who's going to win that inch. And I know, because in 10 years of stand-up, I've died more times than Sean Bean has in his professional career. Now, I can't make you do it. You've got to look at the guy next to you, look into his eyes, and I bet you feel uncomfortable now because you're listening to this on the bus and you've already held eye contact too long. And really, you shouldn't be sitting next to him and you're both wondering if you can spread coronavirus via your eyes. But I think if you look closely, you're going to see a guy who will go that extra inch for you. You're going to see a guy who will sacrifice himself for this podcast because he knows when it comes down to it, you're going to do the same for him. And you're also going to reach out, grab his phone, subscribe him to the show, and then politely wipe down his phone with an antiseptic wipe. That's a podcast team, friends, and either we heal now as a team or we will die as individuals, and that is podcasting, guys. That's all it is. Now, what are you going to do? And with me is the unlikely last-minute winner to my embarrassing first half claps, Barry McStay.
And that's our show. Thanks, guys. I haven't seen Any Given Sunday in so long. That's brought back so many memories. That's... Also, do you know that they had another actor in mind for that role?
The Pacino role? Did
they? Yeah.
Rob Schneider?
No, Rob De Niro. They were obviously going, well, it's got to be one or the other of them. And the young Jamie Foxx, that role they were considering giving it to Sean Diddy Combs. Tell you what, sports films, there's nothing like a sports film to give you, like, endless amounts of cameos, both good and bad.
Oh, so many cameos. If you had to pick a sport, what sport would you pick to make a movie?
Oh, hasn't been a good... I mean, everyone's now fancying Gaelic football players, thanks to normal people. So there hasn't been a good, like, hurling or Gaelic football movie yet. And I think we're, you know, because the shorts are short. And when you've got Paul Mescal's thighs, you know, you can really sell a movie. Just put them on the poster. Listen, before we pitch all of our ideas, let's get an expert on. Our guest this week is a comedian who's been described by comedy review site Chort as having a waspish charm, meaning he's delightful to spend time with, but whenever you try and get him to leave a room, he'll only do so via the window and after 10 minutes of bumping into the glass while being threatened with a rolled up newspaper. Half Welsh and half Spanish, he has to be careful how he pronounces the name of the town of Clonakilty, lest he sprain his tongue. Having plied his trade all over Europe since 2010, he also produces sketches for online platform BBC Sesh, where he has over 15 million views, like a debate on Twitter. He has performed to sell out audiences at festivals including Edinburgh and Brighton, and in 2016 produced and hosted a comedy show for Made Television called Comedy Sheep Stand-Up, which wasn't bad at all. His jokes have appeared in Time Magazine, Metro, The Last Leg on Channel 4, and BuzzFeed. And you won't believe what happened next! He appeared on Worst Foot Forward. Please welcome Ignacio Lopez.
Hooray! Thank you for having me, guys.
We don't have enough guests cheer their own introduction.
This is the first podcast I've ever been on.
Is it?
Yeah, it's, really? I feel like it's a rite of passage for a comedian. Yeah,
you've jumped straight into a threesome times. For your first one as well.
Say again.
And you've jumped straight into a threesome for your first time. I'm impressed.
I'm a very confident man.
Oh, we feel very blessed to be your first time. How have you spent lockdown? What have been your highlights and lowlights?
I mean, it still feels like we've just gone into lockdown. It's just this weird time warp where, you know, it's been a long time, but it feels like it was yesterday we started. So just on a time loop, I've been doing the same thing, writing as much as I can, contacting people, avoiding my family, which has been much easier because now I can't travel to see them. So it's been super useful in that respect.
just living your most intense life.
Yeah, for sure.
You're clearly very good at making the most of a bad situation then. We always ask our guests what are the worst at. What would you say you're not so good at?
I am worst at switching off a film. Like, I cannot stop watching a movie. It doesn't matter how bad it is. I will watch that film to the bitter end. You know, I've had friends complain and leave the cinema, and I've been sat alone watching a film, finishing it. So, you know, I rarely get any sleep if a film starts at 1 a.m. and I haven't seen it before. I will be there till the end credits.
And that is always when the best films start. They never put the real classics on at, like, 9 o'clock prime time. You always get some trashy action film. And then you're like, ooh, 1 a.m. in the morning, Citizen Kane, yes, please.
Exactly, yeah.
I don't know that I've switched off many films. I haven't left the cinema in halfway through any films. I usually sort of bed in and go, well, this is terrible. I may as well, like, bank all of the terrible moments so I can relate it to someone afterwards. Like, I saw way back in one of our first episodes, we talked to Stu Goldsmith about... Now You See Me, the magic film.
Oh yeah.
And I saw this. I saw it and the sequel, Now You See Me 2, disappointingly not called Now You Don't. And I took my husband to it, who hadn't seen the first film, and there were so many bits in it that referenced the first film. So first of all, it was slightly unintelligible to him, but then also they weren't doing magic, they were doing miracles. Like, he can't fall into the pavement in Greenwich and then be in Covent Garden. That's just not how physics works.
Yeah.
And things like that. So it sort of gets halfway through, you're like, I don't know who's working for who. I don't know who the good guys are, who the bad guys are. They're clearly all like the new reincarnations of Jesus. We may as well just go with this and not care too much about it. But I have the same thing. I can't leave a theatre at the halftime either. Like, and theatre gives you an interval. Like, you're allowed to leave the auditorium for 15 minutes and bail out if you really think it's shit. And I always give plays the benefit of the doubt.
I'm going to turn this around.
Yeah, you never know. The first half might be being deliberately shit so that the second half, like, performs some amazing, like, coup de théâtre, like, and it goes, oh, we lowered your expectations so we could then subvert them in some interesting way.
You think they have team talks, like, halfway through a play? Like, we got to pull our shit together, guys. This is not on.
Well, can you imagine being on Broadway in a play with Al Pacino and you've absolutely ruined the first half and Pacino's like, I'm bringing out the speech. I'm bringing out the speech. We are going to rewrite this play in the second half live on stage and inch by inch, company, inch by inch. I mean, and imagine if he was doing that speech in the middle of a production of Measure for Measure. It would be perfect.
Oh, man. I saw a reviewer in at half time. He's up there laughing his ass off.
This week, ladies and gents, we are talking about the world's worst sports movie, and it is a delightful Patreon special and the first of its kind. This is a Patreon special that is paid for by Catherine Adams, so thank you, Catherine, but she's done it as a birthday present to our regular listener, Hannah Wallace. So together they've decided that they want us to talk about the world's worst sports movie, and Barry is going to both kick and bully off.
Yeah, it's nice to know that you know, when Ignacio goes back to listen to this episode, he won't be able to switch off halfway through. He's gonna have to go all the way to the end. I mentioned the alternative reality of Any Given Sunday. I read about some more films that could have gone in slightly different ways. You know the song You're the Best from The Karate Kid? It was originally written for Rocky 3 and then it was replaced by Eye of the Tiger.
Wow.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
I want to recut both movies, switch the songs over. That's what I want to do now.
I mean, they both kind of work, but you, so if you put them side by side, you go, definitely, Eye the Tiger kind of fits Rocky a little bit more. But they're both in that same sort of bracket. Now it's been in front of us the entire time. We just never realised that they're basically the same song. Cher has a habit of being nearly cast in sports films.
She
was nearly cast as Adrian in Rocky.
Oh, that would have been perfect.
Yeah, interesting.
That'd be good in that role, yeah.
And she was also nearly cast in a film which I hadn't heard of called The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
Oh, yes, she was.
Do you know this film?
I have got a lot to say about this film.
Oh, excellent. Well, I'll sort of briefly say that the brief plot is that it's a basketball team who are struggling and they consult an astrologist who says that in order to turn their fortunes around, they need to hire players who are all born under the sign of Pisces.
Wow.
I thought it was going to be an Air Bud type film where, like, a fish which can play basketball saves the team.
Yeah.
But yeah, Cher was nearly cast as the astrologist. The role eventually went to the amazing Stockard Channing. So, you know, equally good choice. And the studio that made The Wrestler, the Darren Aronofsky film, Aronofsky obviously really wanted Mickey Rourke. The studio were insistent that it should be Nicolas Cage.
Oh, I mean, Cage could do the physique of a grizzled old wrestler, but he one thing Nicolas Cage can't do is genuine pathos.
Yes.
Have you not seen Face Off?
He doesn't do it by half measures either, does Nick Cage?
No.
Well, but the thing is, there's going to dark places in like a brooding Willem Dafoe way. Yeah. Or he's going to a dark place in sort of like an artful Javier Bardem way, and there's going to a dark place with a fucking umpar band of emotions like Nicolas Cage does.
I think, you know, when actors are kind of like trying stuff out on set and or you know, in rehearsal stage, I feel like Nicolas Cage lives in that zone, you know, like he just lives in that experimental point where an actor will try something out once and go, no, I'm not doing that again. Nicolas Cage lives in that zone and it's impressive.
Yeah.
So every match is a pre-season friendly for Nicolas Cage.
He's trying Cruyff turns, step over after step over, scorpion kicks, the whole lot.
It's like, mate, you're in goals. Like, why are you doing this?
Teen Wolf, the classic American story of a boy who's only good at basketball when he turns into a werewolf, starring Michael J. Fox. Disappointingly, not Michael J. Wolf. The pitch didn't go down so well in like other countries outside of America, so they marketed it differently. So in Brazil, it was marketed as The Boy from the Future because to try and tie in with Back to the Future. And in Italy, they went so far, they called it Wants to Win in Italy, but they changed the character name from Scott to Marty in the dubbing. It's amazing.
Do you think people went to watch that film in Brazil and thought it was a sequel to Back to the Future?
Yeah.
Doc Brown's going to show up at any point and solve this whole situation. Yeah. It's your children, Marty!
It's your cubs, Marty! We got to talk about your cubs!
Yeah.
Bended Like Beckham also had to adjust itself for foreign markets. Have you seen Bended Like Beckham?
I have.
Parmin de Nagra. About Jess and Jules, two young women who end up playing football. And it's got so much like lesbian subtext. And like both their families being like homophobic and scared of the daughters being lesbians and all of this stuff. And in the original film, they're meant to end up together, but they shied away from doing that. And so for a lot of commentators online, like this was like my first like lesbian awakening film. Keira Knightley said they should do like a lesbian sequel to it and stuff like that because they kind of biffed it first time round. but if they had had that in it, they wouldn't have had the dubious accolade of being the first Western film to be shown on television in North Korea.
What?
The first one.
Bend It Like Beckham is the first Western film to be on North Korean TV. And it did so after winning an award for its music at the Pyongyang Film Festival.
Wow.
Please tell me that Knightley showed up there.
She's an
absolute bastard for an award ceremony.
She loves them. Couldn't get away from the red carpet. Why is it red? Don't ask. And in Raging Bull, they took measures again, thinking about how it would be received. Marty Scorsese said they did it in black and white for two reasons. One, to differentiate it from Rocky, which had been released 4 years previously, just to make it look different in case people, confuse the two. And also, he was slightly reticent about showing that much blood in the fight scenes in colour. So they did it in black and white, which also meant they could use Hershey's chocolate for the blood because it shows up better on the film.
Wow.
Tricks of the cinema. But listen, I've got to get on to my suggestion for the world's worst sports film. And I'm gonna be upfront about this. I don't think I'm going to win this week because I'm naming the Mighty Ducks. But I'm doing it for one very specific reason.
Go on.
A bit of background, first of all. I presume you've both seen The Mighty Ducks, a classic of anyone who grew up in the 90s. Ben's making a face. You must, you've probably seen it.
I'm aware of both ice hockey and ducks and Emilio Estevez, so I think I can put those three variables together into a movie.
Yeah, there you go. It's made by Disney. There you go. You know how the film works out, basically. After a Minneapolis lawyer, Emilio Estevez, is sentenced to community service for drunk driving conviction, he begins coaching a Pee Wee League hockey team made up of misfits and delinquents. And haunted by past shortcomings, while on the ice he tries to coach teamwork on the way to the cup. That's the basic premise, and there's a couple of sequels, D2 and D3, and the iconic moment is this bizarre, like, maverick manoeuvre the team do called the Flying V, where they all sort of skate in a V formation with the puck being passed around from person to person before shooting, and apparently it's unstoppable. Firstly, just a nice bit of trivia I read is that during a kissing scene between Emilio Estevez and Heidi Kling, it was so cold in Minnesota where they're filming that their lips stuck together.
Oh, wow. And Jeff Daniels watched that and thought, I've got an idea for an iconic sequence in a future movie.
Apparently the makeup artist had to drop warm water on their lips so they could separate. The film was panned by critics. It's only got a rating of about 23% on Rotten Tomatoes, but an audience rating of 65%. Our old friend Roger Ebert wrote, "It must be said that this movie is sweet and innocent, and that at a certain level it might appeal to younger kids. I doubt if its ambitions reach much beyond that." And Desson Thompson, writing in the Washington Post, said, "Those not yet wise to formulaic pablum are likely to enjoy this ice hockey kiddie ensemble comedy, but their older escorts might want to bring a novel and a flashlight, or a Walkman, or portable television with earphones." Really dates this film, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The reason I'm picking them is for the commercial tie-in that happened alongside them, because there is a hockey team called the Anaheim Ducks, which were founded by the Disney company as the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim as a commercial tie-in to the movie. And quoting from an article I read here, looking back, it's difficult to fully grasp just how bizarre the creation of the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim was. Disney, the family-friendly all-American media titan with no history of sports management, had formed a professional sports team. And not just any team, a hockey team. This being the sport in which brutal fights are commonplace, teams have nicknames like the Broad Street Bullies, and most of the loyal fan base is Canadian. So what did Disney do? They named their team after a G-rated kids movie. So Michael Eisner, who was the CEO of Disney at the time, was a hockey fan. And let's be clear, hockey was not a major sport in America until basically the early 90s. It was the runt of the litter of the Big Four, as they're now called. But he was a hockey fan. He was a New York Rangers fan. But also, he was the CEO of Disney with enormous reach. And so when the NHL was expanding its product, Eisner was, and Disney were also trying to expand at the time as well. They were rebuilding, they were building new parks such as Disneyland Paris, and they were expanding existing parks, and they had bought ABC and ESPN and Miramax, and they were making more and more films, including the Mighty Ducks film. And Eisner didn't know that the Mighty Ducks film was going to happen as well as a hockey team. He had in fact already declined four times to make a hockey team when he was approached by the Los Angeles Kings owner, but it did well at the box office, so he thought, yeah, maybe a hockey movie. Maybe a hockey movie. He said in an interview, the movie was our market research.
Wow.
Yeah. Ugh. And Anaheim is where Disneyland is, and the Disneyland was being expanded, so it was a convenient city to set up a hockey team. Even more conveniently, the city of Anaheim had built a sports arena with no idea of what sports team was going to inhabit it.
Oh, that's so American, isn't it? It's like, we want a sports team incorporated here. We'll decide once we've done a little bit of marketing to find out what we actually want.
Yeah, they had built a sports arena in the hope of luring one of the teams there. The arena became the Pond, which was the original name of the arena for the Ducks. Now it's called the Honda Center. And they joined the NHL when the NHL was expanding between 91 and 94. They joined in the 1993-94 season. And it had a lot of attention around it. It was basically a Hollywood creation masquerading as a hockey team. The franchise took off. They had, like I said, they had a couple more Mighty Ducks films. Wayne Gretzky appeared in it. To be fair, the hockey team took off massively. Their merchandise, with it's the famous images of like a hockey mask, but it's like a duck's face. That's their logo.
Yeah, which, can I just say, has got, like, they've not managed to get rid of the Friday the 13th vibe.
Yeah, oh, more on that in a minute.
Excellent.
But yeah, at the time, during the late 90s, the Mighty Ducks merchandise was outselling all other NHL teams combined and accounting for 80% of the NHL's $1 billion in merchandise sale.
That's amazing.
The film screenwriter of the original film, Steve Brill, sued Disney for 5% of the profits, arguing that the team was part of the first film's merchandising efforts and he should be given a cut of it. All of that aside, and if you want more info on the Mighty Ducks movies in general, you can listen to Quack Attack, a podcast which is over 200 episodes on the topic at this point.
What, purely about the Mighty Ducks?
Oh yes Ben,
that makes me feel that, you know, sometimes I look at our podcast feed and think, what am I doing with my life, and then realize compared to that we have essentially done the podcast version of War and Peace.
Yeah. But let me take you to my specific world's worst film, which is the opening ceremony film from the opening day of the Anaheim Ducks' first game in the NHL on the 8th of October 1993. Oh yes, they had an opening ceremony. And oh yes, it did open with Lumiere from Beauty and the Beast ice hockey, ice skating on the rink, saying, basically doing Disney on Ice, doing, esteemed hockey fans, it is with deepest pride and greatest pleasure that we welcome you tonight to the Pond. We invite you to relax and take your seat as the city of Anaheim, the National Hockey League, and the Mighty Ducks celebrate a new era in sports entertainment.
I didn't realise that Lumiere was Russian.
Comrade Lumiere, yeah. He is then joined on the rink by the Decoys. It was the 90s is the period of the Ice Girls, which is, you know, cheerleaders but on skates. And they're initially dressed as French maids, skating along to, yep, Be Our Guest.
Great.
Lyrics include, be our guest, yes, duck season has come, inaudible. Tie a bird call round your neck, my friends, and we'll provide the rest. Because, yes, they had given everyone in the audience duck calls to blow at certain moments of the game. Also, more lyrics, make it loud, stomp your feet, mighty ducks, we can't be beat, catch the spirit, it's outrageous, tell your friend that it's contagious, we can skate, we can score, you keep coming back for more, cause the hockey here is never second best. And later on, if you're stressed, get some hockey, we suggest. I've never thought of ice hockey as like a stress relieving sport ever. The song cranks up into a rock version of Be Our Guest then as well. So like they strip off the maid's costume and it's like early 90s rock guitar playing. This lasts about 3 minutes. And then a futuristic spaceship style Zamboni drives onto the ice. It's like a vehicle that goes on the ice. But basically, I suspected this and then read it to be true. It was a former prop from Disneyland. So it's clearly a bit of a ride that they've put out on the ice. And a voiceover says, "From the you can watch all of this, by the way, the entire thing's on YouTube. From the depths of the pond, the mighty Iceman cometh. And a silver-painted rocker guy climbs out of this machine." He's just a guy in, like, silver clothes with silver face paint and, like, a hat with jewels on it.
So in my mind, that's like a bejeweled version of the Tin Man from Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, but he's like done up like Axl Rose.
Of course.
Yeah. And he clambers onto the Zamboni very unsteadily. He clearly doesn't like the ladder and the moving Zamboni. Apparently, he's also not a skater, so he's wearing spiked tennis shoes, not skates. And then he basically just does some audience hype where he's like getting the crowd to cheer and getting to like join in to the accompaniment of Rock and Roll Part 2 by Gary Glitter.
Oh, that's not great.
And then he says, "All right, people, now I've got you all cranked up. Are they, though? Are you ready to meet your mascots?" Muted cheers. "Are you ready? I can tell you are." He begs the crowd to blow on these duck calls they've been given to summon their mascot, Wildwing, from the rafters of the building. He has to do this 3 times because the audience are that unenthused. And eventually, Wildwing swings down on a zip wire from the ceiling, accompanied by O Fortuna from Carmina Burana. And I want you to picture in your heads a massive oversized duck mascot on a zip wire with O Fortuna playing, gesturing to the crowd. While, Ben, you mentioned this, the face mask, the duck face mask, a giant version of that is hanging in from the ceiling as well with glowing red eyes. It's amazing.
I mean, it sounds super entertaining. I mean, whether or not it's
mate, fairly... at the end, when they cut back to the commentators at the end of it, one of them goes, "I have a feeling somewhere Merriam-Webster is rewriting the definition of extravaganza." The crowd then go wild because some skaters with hockey sticks appear in the Mighty Ducks shirts. It turns out these are not the team. I think they think they're the team, which is why the crowd cheer. It's just people lining up to create a tunnel for the team to then skate through. And they announce the team on through this corridor. The announcer cuts off the Iceman, who is trying to do some more hype to start announcing the team on. And because there's loads of people in hockey squad, this takes like 3-4 minutes of the announcer just announcing people onto the ice. And then there's like another rock arena thing being played and loads of people skating around. And Wildwing, this duck, is playing air guitar with a hockey stick that at the end of the song shoots out fire.
Oh, I love... Clearly, the creative director for this was Gene Simmons.
Mate, it's whoever directed the opening ceremony of the Oscars in 1989, I think.
Yeah.
With Rob Lowe and Snow White. The Ducks went on to lose the game 7-2.
Good.
And as a little postscript, Matt McKelvey, the man who played the Iceman, didn't even get to do his end-of-quarter act the whole way through the match because as the team were going down, hockey fans, they can be brutal. We're losing the first game. I'm running around trying to be this silly character. They were on me pretty good. He got booed during his like act when he was singing Twist and Shout. And so the people who were like running the event, the same room manager, like, "Don't come back on for halftime. Don't come back on. Just like go out." He apparently went and sat in his car and cried afterwards. In an interview, he said he hadn't done that since he saw the film E.T.
Oh.
He seems the interview I read of them. He seems to have a really fun sense of humor. He said every time he drove past the stadium from then on, he used to give it the finger. He has never been inside it ever again, and he is a Los Angeles Kings fan anyway.
I didn't think that the Mighty Ducks could literally break a man.
They did.
When I was looking at sports movies, because I've seen a bunch in my time, because obviously I can't switch off the TV if I see a movie, so I've seen a lot of sports movies. Like Mighty Ducks wouldn't have even entered my mind for it, because even though it's super formulaic, I remember it being really fun when I was a kid. I think they got worse as they went along. So when you said Mighty Ducks 1, I was like, how can you pick Mighty Ducks 1 as worse than Mighty Ducks 3? Like, they get progressively worse. But you know, they all follow that fun American underdog story of a group of misfits get together, you know, like the Bad News Bears or all of these kind of like movies, the big American sports. But the film I've chosen, I thought I'd pick quite a left field idea with mine, but you know, the opening ceremony of the launch of a team, which like that sounds pretty horrific, but I've selected 2002's Rollerball remake. I don't know if you've seen the original Rollerball, which is a bit of a cult classic from the 70s. But the remake was just an absolute disaster from the get-go. So they've removed all kinds of social commentary. And it is a fictional sport, by the way. I will say Rollerball is a fictional sport. But I think it qualifies as a sports movie because it's pitched as one. It's a science fiction sports movie. I like mashups, all right? So,
can you describe exactly what kind of sport Rollerball is?
Effectively, when they originally came up with the idea, and in the book as well, and the movie, the original movie, it's supposed to just be like a sign that sports are getting so violent that the type of sports that people will want to watch in the future is just utter violence. So it's a kind of combination. It's a bit like ice hockey. It's a bit like roller derby. It's a bit like American football. It's all of these things, but also including motorcycles and, you know, just... you know, spikes, and it's just this crazy, almost like gauntlet, like gladiator style, but you score points and you score goals and stuff. So that's what Rollerball is.
I defy anybody to say they wouldn't watch a game which was like basically roller skating hockey, but also with motorbikes.
Yeah, exactly. It's the pitch for the actual sport itself. It's like, I would probably watch that there. I'll give it at least a watch, you know. Well, I'll probably watch a season and see how it goes, see how it pans out, if my team wins or not.
I mean, I'd really love to watch a rollerball game featuring the Mighty Ducks.
Just a bunch of...
under eights on my motorbikes with sidecars with flails and maces taking their faces off.
Whack, 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 whack.
It's hunting season. It's duck hunting season. That was the tagline for the movie. Rollerball meets the Mighty Ducks.
Oh my God. Well, there has been talk of a fourth Mighty Ducks movie. I think we finally got our plot.
Wow, okay, let's do it. Let's make it happen. The reason I think that the remake, Rollerball 2002, is so bad is it had a lot of problems behind the scenes. And also it doesn't follow the kind of underdog kind of like format that all sports movies have. Like the only thing that a guy has to overcome, for starters, like the main character is a sports superstar in the film. So Chris Klein plays like I think he's an NHL, you know, he's going to be first draft pick or whatever, and they managed to lure him to this sport, Rollerball, this hyper-violent version, because for more money. So he's this already this superstar who drives fast cars, you know, he's a good-looking Hollywood hero guy, and they get him. And the kind of dynamic of the film, the thing that drives the plot is that Jean Reno, who runs the sport and the team, he is specifically trying to get players hurt and killed in order to boost ratings. So this actually, it actually sounds like the real life behind the scenes of Michael Eisner in the Mighty Ducks.
Yes. Right?
It seems like the whole kind of business thing, but it could have been this great social commentary on turning, you know, sport into entertainment and, you know, exploiting people, because at the time as well, huge thing with American football and injuries, and they were covering them up and this sort of thing. But they just went, no, what we're going to do, we're going to give this an early 2000s new metal soundtrack. We're going to make it look like the coolest sport ever. And it just loses all sense of message. Slipknot are in it.
Yes.
Slipknot are in the film playing during the sport, you know, to try and they set it in Kazakhstan. Like, I'm not this. It's setting because you know it's got that whole kind of stereotype of like, oh well, abroad we can get away with more. It's really violent abroad, not in America. Like, you know, I'm sure that we can do more kind of stuff over there. It's just, it's a complete disaster of a film. It was, and it's directed by John McTiernan, who is a great action director. I mean, he did Die Hard and Predators. You know, he's a great film director, but it was a mess. And also, he got arrested, or the FBI questioned him because he illegally wiretapped the producer of the film because he was unhappy with the direction that the producer was taking it in, and he wanted to make it into more of an action movie. So it's just a crazy film all around with no message, no payoff, insane amount of reshoots that would make Zack Snyder like embarrassed. It's just it's a just disaster of a film.
I just read the name of the private investigator he hired to illegally wiretap this producer, and he's got the best, like, he's got the most private investigator name ever. He's called Anthony Pelicano.
Oh, yes, please. I mean, the thing is, 5 years ago, that's a perfect private investigator name. Now, that's definitely a Donald Trump chief of staff name.
Isn't LL Cool J's in it as well, isn't he?
Yeah, the cast is great. And, you know, Rebecca Romijn as well. I don't know if that's pre or post Stamos. So, you know, it's got a really strong kind of cast for the time and stuff. And I've got to be honest with you, in any film, it doesn't matter how bad it is, I can watch Jean Reno. I think he's fantastic in everything. I think he's a great, very fun actor. He does chew the scenery a little bit in this movie, playing the rich billionaire owner of this sports team. Great cast, you know, but they just didn't know what they wanted to do from a movie. It makes no sense. The film makes no sense. They shot an entire scene at night. Then they realized they filmed it too dark, so they went and reshot the movie, delaying it by 6 months. Then they realized it still wasn't good enough, so they gave it a night vision filter to make it look like it was shot in night vision, which makes no sense, because it wasn't like a perspective or anything. It was like some scenes were, but like you shot a Hollywood film and then made it look like it's in night vision. It was a series of bad decisions made this film.
I'm reading here that they had an original score by a guy called Brian Transo, which also was removed and delayed production because apparently the score sounded, and I'm quoting here, too Arabic. And it was replaced by a new score by a guy called Eric Serra. This is in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, so I presume people in America were very wary of anything being too Arabic. And no wonder they set it in somewhere foreign, I don't know, Kazakhstan.
Well, you know what you were saying earlier about, you know, there's just, and back then America, you know, most people in America couldn't put, you know, they couldn't put a pin in a map where Kazakhstan is, but just the Middle East in general was just seen as kind of like, oh, well, that's what caused 9/11. So let's go after that and stuff. Talking about casting decisions, like you said, Nicolas Cage was actually offered the role in this.
Yes.
But he went off to do Family Man instead. And Keanu Reeves was originally supposed to play the main character in this, between Matrix movies. He'd done obviously the first Matrix film. And then before the sequels, he turned this down to go off and do Hardball, which is a great sports movie, which I really like. Obviously, it's a bit cheesy in places, but that's got a nice sucker punch kind of moment.
I think that if they were going to cast Nicolas Cage in a remake of Rollerball, what they needed to do was to use CGI to superimpose his face on every single player.
You know, and the ball. Just... And the ball. That might have saved it. Let's get John McTiernan on the phone.
Listen, it has 3% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Surely Nick Cage playing all the characters would bump it up to at least double figures.
So if we're going to remake Rollerball for 2020 then and try and avoid this horror show that you've watched and hated it, what are we going to do to improve it? Who are we going to cast in it now?
Well, I'm not going to lie. Your idea of sticking the Mighty Ducks in there, I think, is a fantastic premise. I don't think we'd get the rights from Disney to be able to do that. So I think, you know, make it, cast kids in it. Make it like a Bugsy Malone style thing. Have all this violence in it, don't cut the violence, maintain everything. Obviously, you know, cut the nudity. That was the reason they cast Rebecca Romijn in the first place. Let's not go down that road. But I think just put kids in it, have it this hyper-violent game, and bring back the social commentary, you know, make it more critical of this idea of, like, what are these big corporations chasing and the exploitation of people and stuff. And I think it might pack more of a punch with kids in it as well.
And then you can hire someone like Tom Holland, who is like, can be the grizzled old veteran because he's basically just 23 or whatever age he actually is. And you give it some like Hollywood kudos alongside that there. You got like all these new upcoming kids and then grizzled veteran Tom Holland, who's like, was like a successful American footballer or was going to be, and he didn't get drafted. And now he's like down in his luck coaching people in, I don't know, let's say Colombia. We can have like a drug subplot.
Yeah.
I don't know if Tom Holland could ever look grizzled. He looks like his blood type is moisturizer.
when you prick him, he bleeds Clearasil.
Yeah.
Well, let's have Tom Holland's dad, Dominic Holland.
Yes.
But we'll mocap, we'll motion capture him, but Tom Holland playing the part. So we'll use Dominic Holland's body and face, but Tom Holland can give the performance.
Sorry, with all due respect to Dominic Holland, we've gone from Nick Cage playing all the characters via CGI to respected but little known comedy writer Dominic Holland playing all the characters. you mentioned Rebecca Romijn with her top off. Time Out's Trevor Johnson wrote a review of this film where he says, "It's a checklist shaped by a 15-year-old mall rat. Thrashing metal track, skateboards, motorbikes, cracked heads, and Rebecca Romijn with her top off." And Roger Ebert, who again is a friend of the show, called it an incoherent mess, a jumble of footage in search of a plot, meaning, rhythm, and sense. it earned $25 million worldwide compared to a budget of $70 million. Jesus. That. Oof.
Yeah, there was no rollerball team founded in Anaheim off the back of this film. They didn't try and, you know, the merchandise did not carry.
Yeah.
To begin with, we are going to go to Australia and a movie that I couldn't really find much about, but it's got a delightful trailer and an even better name and concept. It is a cricket horror movie called I Know How Many Runs You Scored Last Summer.
Because I looked in wisdom.
Yeah. And it is essentially exactly what you think it is. It is an Australian movie where the bad guy is a insane cricket-loving pommy who has slaughtered members of an Australian team that defeated him. And then the police find out what's going on, so they transport the five remaining members of the team to the most rickety and unsafe-looking safe house that you've ever witnessed, where he proceeds to hunt them down using things like a cricket ball with nails hammered through it. And in one incredible scene, he captures someone, ties them to a chair, inserts a cricket stump in their mouth, and hammers it through the back of their head with a cricket bat.
Oh,
it is hilarious.
Why did this not take off as a franchise instead of Saw?
Yeah. Yeah, well, also, it would work perfectly as a franchise because, obviously, you could have a full-length feature as a test match, and then you could have a TV series as like, a 50-overs match, and then you could have, like, 20-20s as a short.
Yeah, obviously not the first cricket film. There was The Third Man before.
Unbelievable.
They could call a sequel Leg Before Wicker Man.
Oh, my God.
As you were.
Whilst we're on it, let's talk about another brilliantly daft cricket movie. I found a couple. There's one called, obviously, It's Just Not Cricket, which is a 1949 British comedy movie. The plot's great fun. Major Bright and Captain Early are intelligence officers in the British Army of Occupation in post-World War II Germany. They're sent home on leave, but fail to notice that their new batsman is actually wanted war criminal Otto Fisch.
So it's a
secret Nazi hiding in a cricket team. He vanishes on arrival in England, and the two officers are punished by early demobilisation. Uncertain of what to do on Civvy Street, they utilise the skills they learned in the army to set up a private detective agency called Bright and Early. They engage a secretary called Primrose Brown, and her boyfriend invites them all to a weekend country party for a cricket match. What they don't know is that the cricket ball they buy in London actually contains a valuable stolen diamond that Otto Fisch had stolen. It's been hidden in the hollow ball by his friend and protector, Mr. Felix. As the match gets underway, Fish and Felix watch from the cover of the trees and manage to infiltrate the game and steal the ball. A free-for-all chase ensues. Bright and Early manage to recover the ball and the diamond. They now become celebrities and don't lack for eager clients. At the end, Fish is finally seen working for the detective agency, the two detectives still apparently unaware of his identity. So this movie, released in Britain 4 years after the end of World War II, the resolution is, and the Nazi got away with it.
Yeah.
For a detective agency.
But that sounds like they're setting up a sequel there.
Yes, it really does, doesn't it?
You need Fish to like get together with someone called Herr Chips, so you can have Bright and Early and Fish and Chips in the sequel.
When you think of sports movies, gentlemen, there is only one name that comes to mind. Barbara Streisand. And in... In 1979, she was in a movie called The Main Event, a glove story, in which she stars as a perfume magnate called Hillary Kramer, but she loses her company and faces financial ruin when her accountant embezzles her money and flees to South America. Among her few remaining assets is a management contract with an inactive boxer, played by a chap called Ryan O'Neill. Brilliantly, this boxer is called Eddie Kid Natural Scanlon. He is not a natural.
Yeah.
And the movie is basically her managing his comeback and falling in love with him at the same time. And the song for it, I think, won either a Golden Globe or an Emmy. The movie is an absolute stinker, but, you know, Big Babs does what Big Babs does best.
Yeah, he's really well known as well. Ryan O'Neill. He's an Oscar nominee. He was nominated for Love Story.
Oh gosh, it's a name that had absolutely passed me by.
Yeah, yeah, I've just looked him up. He had actually been a former boxer before he became an actor. So it makes sense that he would be in that film with Barbra Streisand.
Well, in that case, well done, Ryan's agent.
Yeah, and do better, Barbra's agent.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, but listen, she had a difficult... The thing is, they'd gone... They clearly heard... Do you know what sports movies have to be? Like Ignacio said, it's all about being an underdog. And yeah. Who could be a greater underdog than Barbra Streisand in a sports movie?
Oh, my God.
I'm going to mention one more movie before I go to my choice. And I think you mentioned it earlier. I think my choice is going to be The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. For one scene in particular that I'll tell you about in a moment, but a brief mention for The Amazing Grace and Chuck, which is a movie where denuclearization and social activism meets baseball. Get ready, gentlemen, for an incredible cast list. This is a 1987 movie directed by Mike Newell, who went on to direct Four Weddings and a Funeral and Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Jamie Lee Curtis, and coming out of retirement to play the president, Gregory Peck.
What?
Yep.
President Gregory Peck, though.
Oh, God, it's what the world desperately needs right now.
Yes. Atticus Finch as president. Oh, sorry, you've lost me now for the next 10 minutes.
Yeah.
There were apparently, you'll be unsurprised to know, in the mid-80s, a lot of movies around denuclearization because of the ramping up in hostilities between America and the Soviet Union. The thrust of this one is a 12-year-old schoolboy from Montana goes on a tour of an American Air Force base and becomes incredibly anxious after seeing a Minuteman missile on this school trip. His fear of this is intensified by a nightmare. He decides to protest the existence of nuclear weapons by refusing to play baseball, which results in the forfeit of a Little League game. This inspires a fictional Boston Celtics player. Boston Celtics, I believe, are an NBA franchise. And they then decide to no longer participate in basketball until there is no more nuclear weapons. This eventually reaches a climax when the president intervenes, personally meets with the schoolboys, and says, "I admire your resolve, but there are practical difficulties in international disarmament." And so the movie concludes. And it's like a weird, underwhelming echo of the Black Lives Matter protests now.
Except for the president, you know, actually meeting the protesters.
Well, yeah, exactly. But it just seems so... I mean, sports activism obviously doesn't seem so unlikely, but my impression of the 70s and 80s with nuclear potential of nuclear war was people went, it's horrible, but we just got to live with it. Whereas at least with all the protests that have happened now, there have been obvious events to spark these protests. But this movie just seems so asinine on the subjects of nuclear war and protest. And like you say, Atticus Fitch is president, but he basically turns up and delivers a really disappointing civics lecture.
This is
You've done your protesting now. It's time to go home, kid.
Yeah.
Clearly, the script sold it to him because it got him out of retirement, and he said the movie was for him a Frank Capra picture for the nuclear age, and I love it. I had no intention to make a movie now, but this story touched my heart, and I had to do it. Honestly, Gregory, you didn't. So for my choice, and it's a heartwarmingly awful film, is something Barry mentioned at the start, The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh, the story of a struggling professional basketball franchise, the Pittsburgh Pythons, awful name, who have a continuous losing streak that makes them the laughingstock of Pittsburgh. And it had some like real big hitters in it, like Julius Erving plays their star player in it, and he's like one of the NBA greats. But
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is in it as well.
Yes, he is. I mean, he's a guy who can actually act. Like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, genuinely brilliant in Airplane, and genuinely a lot bigger than Bruce Lee in Fists of Fury.
Yes.
But as Barry alluded to, the team is reborn as the Pittsburgh Pisces after an astrologer suggests that the way for them to win is to have a team composed entirely of Pisces. And I kind of love this film because mostly for the trailer, where with a banging disco beat, you see the trials where basically every Pisces in a 50-mile radius has turned up, and there are fire dancers and roller skaters and school kids and the elderly, and the trailer has a voice with a disco backbeat going underneath it going, "Take an Indian, a preacher, a midget, a magician, a hit DJ, an Arab," note, not an Arab, it's a black guy wearing an Arab headdress, "an astrologer, and a great big coach. What have you got? It's fish fever. Once you catch it, you're hooked. May the fish be with you." May the fish be with you, gentlemen. That is a trademark rip-off.
Oh my god. That's so good. What I like, though, is that this suggests, because they are a professional basketball team, mm-hmm. they suggest that there are literally no professional basketballers who were born in the month that Pisces is. Like, the entire league, for whatever reason, just bereft. Yeah. There weren't any, like, people who weren't drafted. There aren't any, like, up-and-coming college players. It's, like, it's literally impossible.
Oh, God, yeah, that is a real anomaly, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the trailer, it bills itself as an astrological disco sports spectacular. Which is, that's a lot of things that I love separately together. Not so much. But my favourite, there is a scene where they had to have 10 to 12,000 people in the arena, and they used the actual Civic Arena
for this.
The events manager at the Civic Arena, a chap called Jack Matheson, said, usually the capacity is only 500. They'd cram it into just one section and shoot it that way, but they wanted to get as many people in as possible. So this final scene called for the largest retractable stainless steel roof in the world at the time to be opened so that for the championship game, the home team could arrive through the open roof via a hot air balloon. There's no reason for them to do this.
But Ben, it's an astrological disco spectacular. They've promised us.
Fair. on the day of filming, it was raining outside, and the director was like, we've got to open the roof. And the events manager was like, I have a $100,000 basketball floor. I am not opening a roof so it can rain all over it. At which point the director went, we will call the mayor. And the events manager said, all right, here's the phone. And the mayor agreed to let them do it if he could have a cameo in the film.
Oh,
and
he has
a 3-second cameo.
Fuck off.
Did the mayor want to have a long, successful career in film? was that his like end game all along? That's why he became mayor of the town.
And that mayor was Mr. Tom Hanks.
And the worst part of all is that the mayor wasn't even a Pisces.
Yeah.
Imagine
if they'd made the film on the same basis. No one in the cast or crew could not be born between February and March.
Yeah, it's like those people who are like, I'm going to write a novel, but I will not use the letter E throughout.
Yeah. I was just thinking this, though. So if they were all Pisces, then their birthday is what? In February and March, right?
Yes, yeah.
All the players. So like the second part of the NBA season for them is going to be shit because they're all going to be hungover from celebrating their birthday.
Yeah.
That's going to just ruin the whole half second part of the season for them.
And that also, that undermines the whole idea that there aren't any Pisces basketball players, because that means they were conceived in the summertime,
yeah.
Which is notoriously the horniest part of the year. So, you know. But then maybe it's just an anomaly. You can't get any basketball players born in February, March, and oddly, no gaffers. So the film just struggled really badly with their whole Pisces-only outlook.
And did you say Cher was going to be cast in that? Is that
yeah,
what
Cher was going to be cast in it, but instead it was D.D. Bridgewater, who, you know, was married to the director.
And Stockard Channing. Stockard Channing played that character, didn't she?
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yeah, Stockard Channing as well. D.D. Bridgewater also had a part in it.
Yeah.
It is, it's a glorious, glittery disco ball fuck-up of
a movie.
So, ladies and gentlemen, our suggestions for the world's worst sports movie of all time are Barry's Titanic kids movie, The Mighty Ducks, based entirely on its colossally ridiculous opening ceremony. Ignatio's suggestion of one of the world's worst remakes, 2002's Rollerball, or my suggestion of the stupidly named and stupidly written and stupidly carried out The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh. Gentlemen, are we going to go for a duck, a fish, or a ball? I mean, Barry, you said that The Mighty Ducks isn't going to win, and you're right, it's not going to win, because I think too many people have a place in their hearts for it, and it's more the opening ceremony.
Yeah.
Ignatio, like, Rollerball, the original sounds great, and your remake sounds deeply unnecessary, but I think sort of there's a yin and the yang to the two Rollerballs that balance each other out, whereas The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh is so mad. It's so mad. And I forgot to mention as well that it's got in it Jonathan Winters, who plays Orson in Mork and Mindy. No, sorry. He doesn't play Orson. He plays Mork's son, who is the one who is inside the giant egg, who comes out as a giant baby. And him, Julius Erving, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Stockard Channing, and Debbie Allen, these are people who shouldn't be in the same postcode together, never mind the same movie.
It's one of those films that when you hear the plot of it, you go, who reads this and goes, yeah, that's a great idea for a film?
Yeah, it's the sort of person, like, the people who read that and go, it's a good idea, are real-life versions of the Mel Brooks character from The Producers.
Yeah.
Not the Mel Brooks character, the Gene Wilder character and the Zero Mostel character.
Yeah.
You know, I feel a little bit naughty going for my own suggestion, but honestly, it's so mad, I've got to.
I think that's fair.
Before we go our separate ways, it's time for the world's best news of the week, which we shall keep doing until the end of this pandemic. So we'll see you with some bad news in the 2030s. And we go to Santiago in Chile, where an unlikely superhero has appeared. A gentleman who has proclaimed himself as the Solidarity Batman is going out onto the streets dressed as Batman and handing out gifts of food to the homeless. It is a little bit overblown, a little bit unnecessary in many ways. There's probably a better way to do this efficiently and logistically. But in his own words to a Chilean news channel, he said, look around you, see if you can dedicate a little time, a little food, a little shelter, a word sometimes of encouragement to those who need it. And all the homeless people who were interviewed for this story have said, listen, it's appreciated. It's a beautiful act of humanity from one person to another. Does he need to dress up as Batman? No. Do I welcome the food? Yes.
It seems like a better use of Batman's money than being a one-man vigilante army and spending loads of money on dangerous tech. Just buying lots of food for the homeless seems a much better idea, frankly.
Yeah, precisely. We've said it before, and we will say it again on this show, no doubt, as will others. Batman, Bruce Wayne, just invest in infrastructure.
Yeah.
That's all we
got.
Yeah, and it's quite interesting, though, because, you know, Batman, you know, is this the kind of argument in the comic books and the films? Like, did Batman becoming Batman, you know, create all of these villains around him? Did they become what they were because Batman exists? Who made who? So now that this guy's delivering food to homeless people dressed as Batman, is there now going to be the rise of some Joker in Chile who's going to kind of, in some way, take food from homeless people? I don't know how is this going to work?
I mean, to be fair, it sounds better than anything that DC have offered up as a Batman film in the last decade, so.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think we can all agree that what we really need to see is Zack Snyder's The Fish That Saved Pittsburgh.
It's going to be 4 hours long on HBO Max next year.
By the way, during this recording, I've been recording in my office on Skype, and I'm suffering a bit of hay fever, so I texted my husband, who was in the other room, to ask him to bring me in some antihistamines, which he did, and I popped one and took one. And he brought me in two sleeves, and I've just looked, and one of the sleeves is antihistamines, and the other one is a sleeping tablet. So let's hope that I popped the right one and I don't keel over before the end of the recording.
Good Lord. Yeah, your husband's done real behind one of these doors. he's literally trying to Morpheus you in real life.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, ladies and gentlemen, before my co-host slams headfirst into his keyboard and starts snoring, it is very much time to end the show. Before we go, Ignacio, where can people see you and what can they see you doing when we get there?
If you just keep in touch with me online, at Comedy Lopez on everything, because people can't spell Ignacio, so it's just Comedy Lopez. Everyone can say Lopez on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and I'll be keeping people updated on online gigs I'm doing, live comedy quizzes and all of that kind of nonsense, and just keeping people entertained and happy. That's my plan.
Beautiful stuff. Well, we're all off to talk to Mike Ashley, the owner of Newcastle United, to see if he will invest in players only bought in the Chinese year of the rat. Until next time, my friends, goodbye.
Bye.